Kentucky, providing this committee and Congress with important insights into the nature and the cost of economic and social of unemployment in America, and a number of useful recommendations on how to do a better job of keeping our people at work and our economy in full production. Today, I look forward to discussing alternative policies for achieving full employment and a healthy and stable economy with distinguished witnesses from the administration, from Dr. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Dr. Burns, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. But this morning, we are very honored to have an outstanding leader of Congress, a good friend and a friend of all of us here, the distinguished Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Honorable Carl Elbert. Speaker Elbert has demonstrated throughout his long and distinguished career of public service a keen awareness of the problems of the disadvantaged, the poor, the unemployed, but above all, the needs of our nation. This awareness has been translated time and time again into effective action by the Congress to help alleviate these problems and to give our economy the necessary incentive and stimulant that the times require. It is indeed an honor and a personal pleasure for me to introduce our friend and our respected colleague, Speaker of the House of Representatives, Carl Elbert.
Thank you, Senator Humphrey, and thank you for inviting me to say a few words on this memorable occasion. I know that the Congress of the nation joined me in congratulating you on the great work you have been doing, not only as the United States Senator, Chairman of the Joint Committee on the Economy, but also the special work you've been doing in commemorating the 30th anniversary of one of the memorable acts of this century, the Employment Act of 1926. It's an honor to be included here for with you. The landmark legislation was passed in 1946, symbolized the promise of legal freedom. The right to be free of the fear of joblessness and poverty, and the right to have a good job and a decent wage. But for a generation, this great promise of the Employment Act has gone largely unfulfilled. And for the past 8 years, it has been virtually ignored. Long-term joblessness has pushed a sizable segment of our population into an insecure and alienated way of life, separated from the mainstream of society, and dependent upon an inadequate and inequitable welfare. Some Americans have been able to wait out comfortably the increasingly severe recession that occurred during the last 30 years. For the average American family, however, unemployment has been a financial and an emotional disaster. For the American taxpayer, unemployment has been a deficit-producing life. Why do we have 10 million Americans walking the streets unable to find full-time jobs? Have we lacked the capability or the will to stop this destroyer of our well-being? Have we lacked the resources? I'm sorry to say that we have apparently lacked the desire necessary for him to end the joblessness in his land and his plan. We allowed ourselves to be led astray by the false, misguided, trickle-down, trade-off economics, the Booty Hoover, Eisenhower, Nixon, and Ford. We defeated unemployment under President Truman. We began to achieve full employment under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. The 94th Congress is currently trying hard to redeem the commitment rendered to the American people by our predecessor, the 79th Congress in 1946, to provide work for all Americans, able, willing, and seeking work. There may be some short-term cost to eliminating unemployment, but the cost of any other policy, like the administration, contemplates unemployment above 6% in the 1980s, is far, far higher. The cost is incalculable. For this reason, the Democratic leadership in Congress, and certainly in the House, is offering a strong support for the full employment and balanced growth act of 1976. This bill was prepared through the great and successful efforts of Congressman Paulson and Senator Humphrey and many others who are deeply concerned with the tragic crisis represented by our shamefully high unemployment level. Destiny knocks at the door of the 94th Congress. This Congress cannot, it will not, evade this historic conflict.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we are sincerely honored by your willingness to participate in this conference and your willingness to give us the lead off.
my own unemployment are paid not only by the unemployed, but also by those Americans who are lucky enough to have jobs. We pay socially in terms of very good and better families. We pay economically in lost tax revenue, lost GNP, lost personal services that might have made our country richer and better. Today we turn from recognition of these costs of unemployment and the severity of our situation to the task of charting the road back to full employment, to a healthy and growing economy. The road back is not very easy and it isn't very cheap, but the failure to start on the road back will be more costly. We must look to the combinations of two. Public employment monies should be used to find jobs, which will create other jobs. In this way, we can use public funds as seed money as investment capital. We can look to jobs which build and rebuild infrastructure in our decaying city. For example, funds to employ people in renovating a decaying plant or a decaying pier. These often private sector jobs for the people who have worked in that plant or that pier. Countercyclical aid programs help our cities and towns when their unemployment rate is astronomical, but it pays down as the town recovers. This program should be reenacted by Congress and signed by the President. If this could give character stagnation, inflation, recession together, it taught us anything. It should have taught us the importance and necessity of long-range planning. Currently, no one in the federal government is charged with the responsibility of looking ahead, of warning us about the future, and I want to tip my hat to both Senator Humphrey and Senator Javits, who are moving forward in this effort. Meaningful tax reform is also a route to economic recovery. There are many different views represented around these tables, and maybe few participants can combine some of those views before the day is up into a roadmap for full employment. What monetary and fiscal policy? What programs offer us the surest, fastest route to full employment without double-digit inflation? Now I have the honor of introducing the expert members of this morning's panel. Arthur Burns, Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Alan Greenspan, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors and our discussants. Frank Wallace, President of the Boston Federal Reserve Bank. Byron Johnson of the University of Colorado. Robert Eisner of Northwestern University. Michael Carrick of the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. On behalf of the Joint Economic Committee, we've designated four members to participate formally in the discussion. Our chairman, Senator Hubert Humphrey, a man with a long history and commitment to full employment, and likewise, Senator Jacob Javits, Congressman Richard Foley, and Congressman Brown, all respected and able. Let me lay out the ground rules for this morning's discussion. Each of the participants will have 5 minutes to briefly summarize their views on policies for achieving full employment. The order of these presentations will be as follows. First, Chairman Arthur F. Burns. Then, Senator Hubert H. Humphrey. Followed by Chairman Alan Greenspan, Congressman Richard Foley, Senator Jacob Javits, and Congressman Clarence Brown. Following these oral presentations, the designated discussants will each have an opportunity to question the members of the panel. Following these questions, we will then have an informal dialogue between all members of the panel and the discussants. Senator Humphrey will moderate this discussion to the extent that it is necessary. I know that this is going to be the most productive day. Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator.
Yesterday about that, and indeed, once your state
Well, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity. I didn't realize that I was to make a presentation this morning. However, I'll be glad to speak for a few minutes. This is a 30th anniversary of the Employment Act, and my own association with the Employment Act goes back many years. And looking at the head table, I see an old friend who looks very young and probably still is very young, yet he's been on this Joint Economic Committee, I believe, since 1950. In any case, when I arrived in the city in 1953, he was there, always attending meetings of the committee and asking stimulating questions. And my friend Jacob Javits and you, Senator Humphrey, have been associated with this effort for many years. I'm almost in a mood of reminiscence, partly because I'm getting on in years, partly because I haven't prepared myself for this morning. You know, when I got here in 1953, the Council of Economic Advisors was a shambles, and there was great uncertainty within the Congress whether the Council should be continued. President Eisenhower was uncertain whether to do so or not, and I was assigned the responsibility of formulating a plan for organizing economic advice within the executive establishment. There was very little interest in the council at that time. Congressmen were disillusioned, president was disillusioned, and others. I went to work. Your father, Senator Taft, was a great assistance to me at the time. He believed in the council. I persuaded Jesse Walcott, who was then chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, persuaded Joe Dodge, then director of the budget, persuaded Nelson Rockefeller, who was then chairman of a governmental reorganization committee of some sort, persuaded Herbert Brownell, the Attorney General, and the president himself, the council ought to be reconstituted. I wrote a reorganization bill. They made some changes in the machinery of the council. That was passed by the Congress. But then the problem arose of appropriating money for the council. And the chairman of the Appropriations Committee at the time was a congressman from a very conservative Republican congressman from upstate New York, John Tabor. And John Tabor didn't like economists. He thought they were evil people. There were too many of them in any case, and he didn't see why good money should be spent on a council of economic advisors. And, he just refused to make an appropriation available, and he was czar of the Appropriations Committee, and there we were. And one day he sent a bristling letter to the White House saying that the old gang is still in control and the White House is not cleaning house as the president had promised, and there is this wild fellow Arthur Burns who is appointing a number of radicals to his staff and giving them fancy salaries, and he supplied names and all. Well, this letter was submitted to me in due course, and the letter was a complete fabrication. And at that point, I decided I'd better have a visit with John Tabor. So I went to see John Tabor. I showed him this letter. I said, "Now you submitted false information to the White House. I'm sure you did it innocently, but I'm here to tell you that every word communication is simply untrue. And I said, but I'm here to tell you more than that. I've been around several months and waiting to get the council organized. And you've blocked my path at every turn. And Mr. Tabor, you better make up your mind, and I'm going to give you just about 2 or 3 days to do it. You're going to support the council or I go home. I've got other things to do. And John Tabor looked at me and he said, young man, I was younger that time. He said, young man, I like the cut of your chin and I'm going to support you. I don't need two words. And he did. And then a new friendship developed in this city. And when economists needed money for a census, they would come to me, I would go to John Tabor, and the money became available. Well, this is a very serious enterprise, Senator Humphrey. I've struggled with the concept of unemployment, concept of full employment for many years. I have watched my fellow economists, and I've watched you and your colleagues in the Congress debate numbers. What is the unemployment rate that is to be associated with full employment? Full employment corresponds to what unemployment rate? Well, some people say 4, another say 3, another say 5, another say 5.5, and still others say it used to be 4, and now it's 5 or 5.5. I've deplored this numbers game. Nobody really knows what he's talking about when he throws these numbers around. And I refuse to have participate in any of it. And yet, we do have a problem. A problem in government. In determining whether or not full employment exists and how we may get to it. And thinking about that problem, I delivered a lecture in, I believe it was in 1963, and I delivered the same lecture once again at the 20th anniversary of the Employment Act, in which I presented a concept of full employment that I thought made operational sense at the governmental level. And the concept substantially came to this, that two conditions are required for the existence of full employment. First, the number of individuals seeking jobs is equal to the number of jobs seeking individuals, men and women. And second, that is at prevailing wages. This equality exists at prevailing wages. And second, that the labor market is so organized that those who are willing, able, and seeking work either have jobs or can find jobs in a relatively short period or are available for retraining. Now, that concept of full employment made very good sense to me then, it still does. I persuaded, with much diligent effort, some of my friends in the Labor Department to organize a statistical system that would make it possible to function with this concept. But they ran into opposition, perhaps didn't bring enough energy to the task, and job vacancy statistics did not flourish. And now they've been abandoned. And therefore, whatever promise this concept may have, it's a concept for the future and one that we cannot work with at present. More recently, being keenly aware of the agony of unemployment, being keenly aware of the fact that life in our country has changed since my boyhood, very few of us have the opportunity any longer of going back to the folks on the farm when we lose a job in the city. Ours is now an urbanized society. Family ties are not as strong as they used to be. Many individuals lead lonely lives, and in the stage of the evolution of our society, I've come to the conclusion that government has a responsibility of acting as an employer of last resort. Now, to many, this is a radical concept, but I think, as you all know, I am a fairly conservative economist. I believe strongly in a free enterprise system. And I've tried to meet my own objective with respect to what is desirable in our society within the context of a strong free enterprise economy. Now, to improve, first of all, I think government has the responsibility of releasing the energies of private enterprise so that more jobs will be created and will these jobs be good jobs for our people. I think we have neglected investment in our country. I think we have overtaxed investors, overtaxed business enterprise. And I think reforms in that area would speed capital investment, enable us to bring our costs down in the process and become more competitive in the world, though we haven't done badly in that respect the last few years. I think, secondly, that we've gone much too speedily in legislating and administering environmental and safety programs. The purpose is excellent, but we've been careless over the years, and I don't think we can or should try to correct for all of our carelessness in a very short time. I would stretch out our environmental, our timetable for achieving our environmental and safety goals. I think that would improve job opportunities in this country. Many jobs are being held back by all kinds of lawsuits, and much of the investment that we're having these days is going into a plant which will do nothing to lower cost of production, though it will give us a cleaner air, which we need. Well, we've got to be more realistic, I think, in that respect. In the third place, I think we need keener business competition in our country in many areas, and a reform of our antitrust laws, I think, would be a good thing. Tighter enforcement would be a good thing of these laws. We have a maze of anti-competitive regulations, and I think we ought to get rid of much of that. Fourth, I think that our labor market policies need to be reviewed. This is an area that all political people don't like to enter. But I don't think we can continue neglecting what we're doing to our labor markets. I think the federal minimum wage law is responsible for a great part of our unemployment, particularly among teenagers. I think the Davis-Bacon Act is responsible for much of the unemployment in our construction industry. I think we've become we've liberalized our unemployment insurance legislation to the point where a fair number of people, not energetic, not ambitious, would rather stay on unemployment insurance than go out and look for a job. I think we ought to review our labor market, our labor legislation. Beyond that, our Federal State Employment Service has never been very efficient. With modern technology, we should should have a nationwide computerized job banks, and I've been fighting for that for years, and we still don't have it. It's a great deal we can do in that direction. Beyond that, if we still have unemployment, as we may, I think the government should serve as employer of last resort, but at a wage that would be unattractive. Deliberately unattractive, so that individuals would be helped to get by for a short period of time, but they would also have a strong incentive to create opportunity for themselves, to find a job for themselves, in a regular job for themselves in private industry or in a regular job in government. Well, Senator Humphrey, I've taken more than 5 minutes, I'm afraid, but I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I'm sorry that I've not had the time to prepare a formal statement.
Dr. Burns, I'm really pleased to give that back there for you. You've given us not only a very valuable and interesting historical background, but by the way, a new insight, may I say, on my part from Dr. Burns. I didn't know you brought all the radicals in the government. But I think they gave that story about yourself and Mr. Taylor, one of the little crisis vignettes of American politics. And we thank you for contributing to what is ordinarily not the most appealing public record, maybe the joint economic committee or the statistical evidence to you so often. But your observations that you've given us today, along with the splendid address that you gave at the University of Georgia, which we brought to the attention of some of our colleagues, outlining some of the points that you've emphasized, I think the most helpful one that will be, I'm sure you will recognize that there will be discussions for the one who you have with you. Well, it's now my privilege to make some comment here. I think that most of my colleagues and our participants here today know that I have been, along with a host of others, deeply concerned over the developments in our economy in recent years. I look back over the periods of the 50s and 60s, and while there was some price instability, we suffered some recessions. It's fair to say that in the recent 20 months or so, we've had the most serious recession and the highest level of unemployment and the sharpest turndown in production that we've had since the Great Depression. And it's because of that series of obvious facts that we direct ourselves today once again to the evaluation of the Employment Act of 1946, which is public law, to see whether it is adequate, and also whether or not it has been adhered to. I sometimes feel that the government, as contrasted with citizens, feels that it has no obligation to live by the law. The citizens are required to do so under impact of penalty. But law is law. We have laws that govern central intelligence agencies. We have laws that govern the FBI. We have laws that govern the IRS. We have laws that govern all the agencies of government. We have laws that relate to citizens. Now, the Employment Act of 1946 is a law. It's not just a statement of noble purpose. It wasn't just a sense of the Senate resolution. anniversary of the Employment Act, an anniversary upon which we find ourselves farther from our goals that were established than we were 30 years ago. Such a situation is clearly not an occasion for any rejoicing or singing the Hallelujah chorus, but an occasion for reassessment. It is an occasion to ask why. Why have our goals been only imperfectly realized? Why are they farther from realization today than at any time in the last 30 years? Why is our doubt about our ability ever to achieve full employment? And I accept the definitions which have been handed out here or been stated as of yesterday and as of today, namely, full employment is that condition when those who are willing to work and able to work are able to find the work that will provide them with at least a modicum level of income and standard of living. So why are we in doubt about our ability to achieve full employment with reasonable price stability? And why is this doubt greater than ever? Why do our economic policy-making institutions seem to serve us less well today, yesterday, the last 5, 10 years than they have in the past? Or is this a something of temporary nature with peculiar circumstances surrounding it that may pass away? It is also an occasion to ask, and I think more most important question, what shall we do? We're all experts on problems. We have fantastic statistical gathering organizations to point out our misery. We even developed in this committee what we call the Misery Index, which is a combination of unemployment statistics and inflation. But having perfected our ability to ascertain the misery, we haven't done very well in providing the prescription to alleviate the pain or the misery. And I don't mean just government. However, I think it ought to be stated very clearly that government does have an effect upon the economy, and that's what government is for. It is not neutral. It is there for a purpose. The whole Constitution is a document of action in which the government of the United States is supposed to promote the general welfare, where it is supposed to establish justice, where it is to provide for the common defense and other great necessities of our people. I think it's a time to propose changes in our policy-making structure after having examined it most carefully and to press for the adoption of these necessary changes. Now, what changes are needed is obviously subject to discussion and debate and decision. It is time to update our government machinery to meet new situations, a new type of workforce. Things are different. The period of the 30s, the country was in a large measure rural. Today it is highly urbanized. In the period of the 30s, we didn't know about multinational corporations or conglomerates to any degree. But today they are a matter of institutional economic fact. This is not to prejudge their merits, because there surely are arguments on both sides as to merit or liability. Because I believe that it is time to update our government machinery on economic policy, looking ahead and not looking back, I have therefore introduced, along with other members of the Joint Economic Committee, in cooperation with members in the House of Representatives who are not on this committee, such as Congressman Hawkins, a proposal known as the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act of 1976. In the Senate is S-50, in the House H-R-50, which is designed to strengthen and supplement the Employment Act of 1946. Now, those of us who are legislators know that proposals such as this are subject to revision, to adaptation, but the purpose is clear. The purpose of the proposal is to design a set of institutional, or to design machinery for arriving at decisions. It is a decision-making process that I think is at the heart of our problem. The question is whether we have a coordinated decision-making process or a decision-making process that coordinates the economic facilities and the economic institutions of the government, or whether we have a series of institutions or a series of agencies and instrumentalities that more or less operate on their own. The failure to make wise and timely use of overall what they call macroeconomic policy, but just overall economic policy in the 1970s has been compounded by the failure to supplement fiscal and monetary policy with the broad range of additional policies needed to deal with our complex economy. I think most of us as traditionalists recognize the importance of fiscal and monetary policy. The problem in a democratic society is that people are involved, and the theory sometimes punishes the people. And as one witness said here not long ago, that price stability gained at the price of ever greater poverty for some, or degradation for some, is a price stability policy that is indefensible. In other words, if price stability is to be gained at the price of 7 million, 8 million, 10 million people being left unemployed, then that policy is politically and morally indefensible. Now, theoretically, it is, I suppose, defensible in that if you can wait long enough, possibly fiscal and monetary policy operating through the private economy will produce the necessary results or the required results. But again, I point out that governments based upon consent of the government, governments that are based upon the will of the people, cannot maintain policies over a prolonged period of time which extract from a minority of the people incredible sacrifice, suffering, and pain in order to placate and satisfy just the majority of the people. The test of moral government is not only what it does for the majority, but how it responds to the needs of the minority. The moral equation of democratic government is justice, and not just justice for some, but justice for all. And I don't believe we can discuss economics merely in dollar terms or statistical terms. We have to discuss economic policy with the human equation being a fundamental part of it. Now, I recognize that our transfer payments, I recognize that the many social programs that we've effectuated and passed and legislated over the years has eased the pain. I've often wondered what would have happened to this country had we not have had old age security, pensions, unemployment compensation, food stamps, welfare, supplemental, the SSI as we call it, the supplemental incomes. Might I say that these programs were legislated over tremendous opposition, unbelievable opposition. Now everybody looks upon them at least as necessary. Some of them, some people feel that they have not been properly administered, others feel they're too costly, but there is no one that I know of that really is taken seriously that recommends their abolition. So we have cushioned the pain, to be sure. We have, in a sense, moderated the pain, but we have not, as yet, got at the source of the trouble. And I believe it requires intelligent people in a democratic society to look at why it is that this country, over the long period of time, has a higher level of unemployment than any other industrialized nation in the world. Now, there may be reasons and answers. Because of the composition of our population, because of the size of our country, because of a number of things. But at least we ought to know why. And secondly, I think we need to ask, why was it that in every other recession, prices declined? But in this recession, prices increased. Why these unique circumstances? And I've had no satisfactory answer. Why is it that in every recession or depression that this country has experienced in the 200 years of its history, up until this one, that as the recession deepened, deflation took place, not inflation? This time it was inflation and recession, the twin evils at the same time, a unique set of circumstances that never before has been evident to plague our society. This is why I believe that new approaches are necessary. I would like to believe that what we have gone through is only a temporary matter, but I don't believe we can believe that. And I'd like to believe that the methodology that we've used and the treatment has been effective, but I don't think so. I think it's been the most costly treatment or the most costly approach to the problems of recession and inflation that this nation has ever known. There are very few people who seem to understand the incredible difficulty that American business has gone through. The losses that people have sustained in the market, the huge number of bankruptcies that have taken place in our private economy, and not just because of government regulations, but because of lack of purchasing power and ill-advised and ill-applied economic policy. And again, that while we can say that some suffering has been relieved or removed because of unemployment compensation, union contracts with union benefits, welfare and food stamps, there isn't anyone that I know of that thinks that this is an adequate response to a prevailing condition. So how can we improve policymaking to achieve our goal of full employment? While we can't rely on fiscal and monetary policy exclusively to achieve our employment goal, we must do a better job of setting output and employment targets each year, which overall economic policy should try to achieve. I think one of the weaknesses we've had is the unwillingness or the failure to set reasonable targets for us to look to. I've at times been critical of Dr. Burns and the Federal Reserve, not Dr. Burns as such, but the Federal Reserve. And I've never forgotten one response. When you said, Dr. Burns, well, what are your goals? What does the Congress want us to do? What is the objective that you seek to attain or achieve? And I think it was a very responsible response that we in the Congress, that are the people's representatives, we push and shove and at times scream and holler, but we have never really said to the government, to the Federal Reserve System, nor have we said to the President or anyone else, that here is what we want as a goal. This is what we ought to be shooting for. This is what we ought to be looking towards. And we'll measure our performance on that basis. Instead of that, we've talked in generalities and at times even in specifics about the rate of inflation or the wholesale price index or the consumer price index. We've complained and we've screamed about it, but we have never said, all right, in the year 1976, it is our goal and it's by law, by resolution of the Congress, that we are instructing the instrumentalities of the executive branch and the other agencies of government, and we in the Congress taking our fair share of the responsibility to lower the unemployment rate to a precise figure as a goal, or to lower the inflation rate, and then to try to pursue policies which would bring it about. Now, I'm not one that believes that government alone can do this, but I do believe that it is necessary for government at least to set the standard. Secondly, we need better economic planning. Instead of careening from crisis to crisis, we should take the time to set long-range priorities and plan, at least to a degree, for labor, capital, and resources needed to satisfy priorities. And we must have a number of supplementary policies in our economic toolkit ready to apply. A permanent counter-cyclical anti-recession grant program for state and local governments to enable them to maintain employment during recession. Temporary public work projects to be triggered when the national unemployment rate rises above 4, 4.5, or whatever percentage point we set it, these jobs would be phased out as unemployment dropped. And then we should have assistance to chronically depressed areas, regions and areas, in the form of job training for the workforce and better availability of capital to encourage industrial development. Finally, we need a reservoir for those who, through no fault of their own, are unable to find jobs in regular public employment or in the private sector. I envision this as a relatively small residual program for the permanently disadvantaged. Although some people express concern about increasing public jobs, and indeed there are defects in these jobs if they are not carefully designed, I find such jobs, even imperfect, far superior to increasing income maintenance and welfare payments. I think the United States of America has been buying itself trouble at a terrible cost of waste of production and human resources. Our next participant is Dr. Greenspan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I believe I probably have ample opportunity to engage in the general discussion, I'll limit my opening remarks to just a few words. I think we're all aware at this stage that we are in the process of coming out of the worst recession since the 1930s, as you pointed out. And by any measure, there's no question that this recession has taken a vast and tragic toll in human suffering and economic costs. And I think, essentially, because of that, we cannot afford to go through what we have just been through again. And I think, therefore, we must be certain that the policies we pursue in the months ahead and the way we view economic policy must be calculated to sustain a steady and durable economic recovery. Policies which will bring the unemployment rate down as rapidly as is feasible, in a manner which will keep it down, and not a whole series of policies which will create wholly new instability in our economy in a situation which could be far worse in the years immediately ahead. We do talk about specific numerical targets for jobs, and I think that I would subscribe to what Dr. Burns has said about the specific numbers involved. I'd also like to make a further point that when we talk about a particular goal, whether it be 3%, 4%, 5% unemployment, we must remember that we're talking about the jobs part of that in the context of permanent, productive, high-paying jobs, jobs with a future, and that we must be careful not to seek as a goal a statistic. And I think there is a tendency too often when we look at this type of job goal or unemployment goal to recognize that it is a proxy for a very broad and very important issue with respect to maintaining type of job markets, the type of full employment, the type of productivity, the type of standard of living which the American worker has been accustomed to. And I think we all must be aware that that is what we wish to achieve, as well as the total concept of job creation and full employment. And just let me say, in closing, that above all, we must continue to reduce the inflationary pressures which have plagued our economy. I believe, perhaps more than anything else, that it is the inflationary instability which we've experienced, which have perhaps inhibited job creation and undercut the type of viable growth this economy needs, that this type of inflationary instability has perhaps done more to create the unemployment and the terrible difficulties that this country has had in recent years. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our next panelist in response is Congressman Bolling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I'll talk economics. I think I'll talk talk about how I see we must proceed to obtain a new consensus or a new compact on how we should deal with the economy. And to do so, I have to talk a little history. And what Dr. Burns said about his experience when he first came to Washington is a part of that history. There's only one member of this committee today, my distinguished friend from Alabama, who used to be my congressman, Senator Sparkman. That's correct. He was here when the act, the Employment Act, was passed, and he's been a member of this committee from the very beginning. And when the Employment Act was passed, virtually everybody in the United States expected the United States to go back into a depression. And the Employment Act, which has been far from perfect, has accomplished quite a remarkable lot. And if I see it correctly, it was, in legislative form, the result of a very hard-fought compromise. And that result spread across both a spectrum of party, but also a spectrum of ideology. There were a great many very powerful businessmen, financiers, who were involved in the Employment Act, as well as a great many other people in labor and liberal groups that were involved in the Employment Act. And nobody was really pleased with the outcome. But it provided a framework in which the political process could work, and the two principal goals of the Employment Act could be considered each year. Now, when there was a Truman in the White House, I think it would be safe to say that there was a great deal more concern about employment than there was about price stability. And when President Eisenhower and Mr. Burns were here, there was more concern, I would think, in the early days about price stability than there was about employment. And I won't go on to make the contrast, because in every case, both matters were considered. Now, that compact, that consensus, whatever you want to call it, that result of a hard-fought legislative battle over a new creation, I think served us rather well. And I don't happen to be able to pick a partisan date that suits me as to when it stopped serving us well. I think on the 20th anniversary of the Employment Act, ironically, it was clear that a Democratic administration and a Democratic Congress, much abetted by the unwillingness of Republicans to deal with the matter, failed to have the tax increase that was essential to prevent the kind of inflation that has plagued us ever since. Now, I happen to think that the policies of the Nixon administration were often pernicious, and would be happy to argue them, but this is not the time to do it. But the point is that the act served us well until about 1966. And now the act and its goals simply are not adequate to the problems that confront us. The economy has changed drastically. Not only are prices more rigid, but wages are more rigid. Not only do we have a higher level of unemployment when we come out of a recession than we used to, we also have a greater threat of inflation than we used to. And we need a new consensus or compact or whatever, because the old one isn't good enough. Now, just the other day, I think we started the action end of that when there was introduced a new Humphrey Hawkins bill. And I'd like to say that the gentleman who spoke first here today, although he didn't appear very much involved in this, was wholly involved in the creation of a viable piece of legislation in the Full Employment and Balanced Growth Act. Speaker Albert has been working on this for about a year and a half, and he has been working on it in a way which was designed to achieve results rather than to achieve fame for anybody in particular. And Senator Humphrey and Congressman Hawkins and their staffs and many others have been involved for months in draft after draft after draft to move a piece of legislation which was a concept that couldn't fly into a piece of legislation which would serve the function that I described. of setting up a kind of legislative battle that would lead ultimately to a compact. I don't have any idea what that legislation should contain in the end. I have my own predilections, my own prejudices, my own views, and they would certainly differ from a variety of other people's. But the point is that the society is going to have full employment with price stability only if the greater community makes that decision, not just the Congress, even with the executive. It is going to have to be something that has gone into so carefully that its results represent a rational approach to the great majority of the movers and shakers in the society. And too often the political process is ignored as we begin to deal with these kinds of matters. I'm informed, I haven't had a chance to check it out, that just the other day, for the first time, the administration indicated an interest in appearing and testifying on the Humphrey Hawkins bill. If that is so, the issue is beginning to be joined, and the product will be the result of the political legislative process, and it will work almost exactly as well as it is understood by the leaders of the community who are not politicians. And the community, as far as I'm concerned, is the United States of America. So I think this is an historic week, and as we did not do in 1966, I think on our 30th anniversary, we're starting something constructive. In 1966, I think we were watching something destructive and reminding ourselves of how well things had gone up to that point. And I hope very much that this year we will be able to join that legislative battle and get leaders of all segments of this society involved in working out the ultimate compromise. I think that's the way, and the only way, we're going to get full employment.
Thank you, Congressman. Our next panelist, and we have two to complete this, and then we go to the discussions, is Senator Jacob Javits. Senator Javits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the Chinese have an expression, every long journey starts with the first step. And it seems to me that the first step, which we are taking now, and which we hope will be joined in by the American people, is an absolute sense of outrage. An absolute sense of outrage that the most productive society upon which the sun has ever risen must tolerate 7 million unemployed and with an enormous attitude in official circles that it's irremediable. We can't do anything about it. Now, this, I feel, we simply cannot accept. People of this country cannot accept. When Franklin D. Roosevelt promised us 50,000 planes just before World War II and made 100, that's the American spirit. This blind abdication of responsibility, which is the root, in my judgment, of our trouble, is a profound national deficiency, which I hope very much that this outcry, and that's what it needs to be here, must correct. Now, Mr. President, let's be very realistic. I'm a politician like all the rest of us here. A president can be elected, notwithstanding 7 million unemployed. There are still 86 million who are employed. But again, that's not our country. That's not its morality. That's not its sense of decency. That's not its sportsmanship. Hence, the correction of this basic imperfection in our society, structural imperfection, which makes us feel that a governmental policy must accommodate 7 million unemployed is simply wrong, unacceptable, and in my judgment, un-American. It's just not our way. Accordingly, I think we all have to interest ourselves very deeply, Mr. Chairman, in what's to be done. Now, Senator Humphrey and Congressman Hawkins have come forward with a methodology. There are certain basic substantive policies which need to be followed, but I'd like to divide my short discourse in two, the methodology and then the substantive policy. Now, the Humphrey Hawkins bill, in which I have joined because I am very anxious to forward all of these efforts, as I will demonstrate in a minute, is a very interesting approach to the methodology which we need to adopt. I have offered my own with also Senator in the balanced growth and national economic planning bill. And it seems to me that the more we talk about this, and by the way, I'll see that it's distributed to an analysis of the bill, is distributed to my colleagues and to the discussants and anyone else that wants it. But the basic assumption of the bill is that the economy will perform better with some kind of long-term planning and some agency to monitor it. And second, that our economic choices and trade-offs are national decisions, which we have to make as a nation, and that the only way to do that is by some form of indicative, not mandatory, planning. I believe that everything that's been said indicates the essential truth of that fact, and that essentially what we're dealing with is, shall we plan nationally with respect to our resources so as to deal with full employment and assure full employment? And furthermore, I think we ought to exorcise the 3%, the 4%, the 5%, etc. The only standard of national satisfaction that we're dealing adequately with the promise of the 1946 Act is that any able-bodied American who wants to work can work. And that, I think, is the essential thrust of Dr. Burns, employer of last resort. Any American who wants to work can work. And let's forget about the percentages. And we all know how untrue that is today. And the panel that sat yesterday, where the discussants sitting, with whatever mistakes it may have made, was united on one thing. And that is not true in America, that there are millions of people who want to work, who don't want to draw the dole or unemployment compensation or anything else, can't work. And that's something deeply wrong in our society. So I've offered this planning bill with Senator Humphrey, and I'm delighted in that association because we're all on the same track, and I joined the Humphrey Hawkins for the very same reason that he joined the Humphrey Javits bill. The other thing is that I've also offered a suggestion in S-472, if we can't get a fully panoply fair employment, full employment statute for a federal full employment board whose sole care will be the adequacy of employment in the country. Now just a few minutes on substantive matters. Governor Rockefeller, Vice President made an extremely interesting statement before this committee yesterday in which he recommended 8 measures, basic policies for substantive action, which would, in his opinion, combine best the private and the public sectors. And I believe that those are splendid, Mr. Chairman. I associated myself with them yesterday. I associate myself with them again. And essentially, what he said is that we can achieve what is called full employment. We all know that it doesn't mean every single person is actually working. But we can achieve full employment by the utilization of both the tensions and the sense of unity which occurs between the public and the private sector. That's why I've emphasized so very strongly planning. And I'd just like, if I may, to move into those 8 points very quickly. Productivity programs in industry, which are very, very far behind the times. We're at the bottom, not at the top of the heap internationally, an extraordinarily strange position for the United States. And this will take an upgrading of skills and a facilitation of the adoption by labor and management of new and improved work rules and industrial processes. And I think the reason why we're so slow in that and why trade unions often seem so sticky is that the worker does not have an adequate piece of the action. He's not only got to have his reform pension plan and the other bedrock assurances which we give him, but he also, in my judgment, has to have a direct piece of the action through profit sharing and or stock ownership. And that will finally get you to the people's capitalism, which is really the United States of America. Second, Vice President Rockefeller recommended retaining our leadership in science and technology. One of the most abysmally depressing documents is to show how far behind we are. Take, for example, Germany and Japan in what we're spending for R&D, research and development, both publicly and privately. We have a very archaic view of money in this country. We think we're in terrible danger because we owe $600 billion. I wouldn't care if we owed $1 trillion, provided our gross national product was $3 trillion. And any industrial company worthy of its salt feels the same way. America, I'd like to say to my chairman, these prices have stayed up partially because of administered prices, inadequate antitrust laws, etc., but mainly because America has lost its boldness and its vigor. Its boldness and its vigor. That's why, and that's why business and workers are losing confidence in our country. That's why your prices have stayed up. They've allowed them to stay up because we've lost our spirit of enterprise. And that, I wouldn't say that's irremediable. I don't accept any such thing or any such word for the American economy. But it's a big problem for us, and we're in the process now of getting at it. The governor, the vice president also spoke of a reformulation of our tax policy, plant modernization, getting to work on an enormous effort to improve our sources, our own sources of energy, which in his judgment would cost $100 billion. And America wasn't afraid to spend $100 billion in World War II every year and ended the war richer and bigger and more powerful than it had ever been before because it spent it to defeat tyranny, and that's not wasted money. And it's the same with this energy proposition. Well, Mr. Chairman, I've taken more time than I should. I'd just like to close as follows. We are a unique society. We all agree on that. And the unique societies have to modernize too. And our modernization, in my judgment, now can be summed up in three words. One, we too, like the rest of the world, has to plan. And we cannot afford, we're no longer a frontier society. We can't afford to get up and navigate by the seat of our pants. So some form of planning statute is essential. Second, the worker has to have a piece of the action. Businessmen have to learn not to be afraid of workers on their boards because they own stock, just like anybody else. They ought to welcome them. And third, America has got to be bold again in terms of research and development, in terms of capital investment, and in terms of dealing with the rest of the world. Now, the world isn't going to get smaller or more constricted. If we do, we will pass from the scene like many other great nations have. But if we don't, we have an excellent chance to lead the world into a new dawn, and that's what we're talking about here. Thank you.
Senator Javits, I'm sure that I speak for all of us when I say we're grateful and thankful for your leadership. Our next panelist from the Joint Economic Committee is the distinguished congressman from Ohio, Clarence Brown, who is the ranking member on the House side of the minority and has been a very significant force in this committee. Congressman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this 30th anniversary observance of the Full Employment Act is to mean more than a political show in a presidential election campaign year, I think we should do more than point with pride or view with alarm. We should use the occasion to reassess our objectives and the methods by which we have tried to reach them. It has, after all, been almost a full generation. In looking back at the 29 years of annual statistics since the Full Employment Act was passed, there are good reasons to both point with pride and view with alarm. We can be proud of the fact that the average unemployment rate during those 29 years was a little less than 4.9%, and that we had 9 years when the annual average unemployment rate was under the full employment target of 4% set by the Committee for Economic Development in 1946. But we must view with some alarm the fact that 7 of those 9 years under 4% unemployment were war years. 3, the Korean War, and 4, the Vietnam Affair. And even more alarming is the fact that the years lagging the years of lowest unemployment saw the highest jumps in inflation, as reported by consumer and wholesale price indexes. We must be concerned that price stability and our classic definition of full employment apparently have some problems coexisting. If price stability is one of the twin goals, perhaps we should look at these years when it was achieved and see what the unemployment rate was. During a non-war decade from 1955 through 1964, relative price stability, about 1.5% increase per year, was achieved. But alas, the unemployment rate in that decade averaged 5.4%, 5% even in the first 5 years and 5.7% in the second 5 years. Now, no policymaker in a free society would deliberately seek increased unemployment